Hello there, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Keyframe on the Geek Show Podcast Network. It's a rather empty house today, as there's only me, Tucky, and I'm joined by Rob.
Hello.
Hello, hello.
We need an echo effect on it. It's kind of lonely without Mark or Andrew.
Yeah, Andrew's ill and Mark is, I think, coming down with something. Possibly if he isn't, then he may just be collapsed after a hard week at work.
So anyway, so he's coming down with something. I was like, oh God, see the sickness. Every time he coughs.
Are you saying, no, because it's not dubstep, but it might as well be. He coughs in dubstep.
Yeah. The dubstep flu.
Oh, that's just it's a thing. It sounds like the, it actually sounds like the disease that would wipe out humanity.
Why aren't we funding research into curing dubstep flu?
First, we have to acknowledge that it exists. It's like it's like man flu. Nobody wanted to acknowledge man flu was actually a thing, even though, you know, generations of men for decades, for hundreds of years, have been complained about man flu. And then all of a sudden, they realized man flu is actually real.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now look where we are. Still, no one believes us.
Yeah, I know. Anyway, we're not here for science, we're here for animation, right? And do you know who else is here for animation? DreamWorks Animation Television.
Here we go.
Yeah.
Looking forward to this.
Well,
put a link up so I can react.
You won't need the spot with this one. You won't need the link, trust me, right?
All right then. Oh. Strong it doesn't need a link.
No, you won't need the link, but you may want to have a look at the image. Associate.
Oh, here we go. I love images.
So, DreamWorks Animation Television is creating two original kids shows for Amazon Prime Video. One of them is going to be a second series inspired by Kung Fu Panda, which is going to be called The Paws of Destiny, and it's going to have a global debut later this year in more than 200 territories, and it's going to be on Prime Video, right?
But so it's a direct sequel to Kung Fu Panda.
No. It's a second series because they've already had a first series of Kung Fu Panda, kind of.
You know. All right. So not with Jack Black, I expect, because he's too big for this kind of like mediocre.
Yeah, it's straight to TV.
Work.
It's like how they, you know, it's like, you know, the Hercules TV shows, and they had the Emperor's New School after the Emperor's New Groove, and Hercules, the High School Years, whatever it was called.
Where they had like Curious George, but Will Ferrell wasn't the man in the yellow hat.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah.
The other one, though, is a bit of a shot in the dark, I'll be honest. I'm not sure how this one is going to play out.
Oh, no way.
Rocky and Bullwinkle. Yep.
Oh, no, that's awful.
I'm shocked, I tell you, shocked. That they're actually going for Rocky and Bullwinkle of all of the properties. It's the Talking Moose and the Flying Squirrel, The Adventures of Rocky and Bullwinkle, and it's going to be a serialized comedy about the two goofball best friends who routinely find themselves thrust into harrowing situations but end up saving the day time and time again.
So yeah, horror, a thriller kind of adaptation of Rocky and Bullwinkle will be amazing.
Yeah, but you know they're not going to go down that route with this. You know what they're going to do with this. They're going to obviously make this into something like Adventure Time or what's it, Regular Show or something like that.
So it's going to be like the Unique Cartoon Network. We're unique, but we're not really unique. But it's going to be a touching thing. But the thing is, like Rocky and Bullwinkle, I have to say I like Rocky and Bullwinkle. And really? My first introduction at Rocky and Bullwinkle was actually the movie.
I was going to say, please say the movie.
Yeah, it was the movie. And then as you watch anything and you realize, oh, well, this has been around for quite a while. It's a really Canadian cartoon.
Yeah, didn't Robert De Niro play the bad guy in that?
Oh, you're going back a few years. I think he did. They had quite a few like big names in it.
Yeah, I know. I think Robert De Niro played the bad. I'm going to have to check on this. I honestly think Robert De Niro played the bad guy in that. I can't remember if that's the truth or not. I just seem to remember him gurning at the camera while wearing a monocle.
Rocky and Bullwinkle and Friends. Oh, here's something you'll really enjoy.
Well, it's coming up on Google search.
Hi, De Niro, Russo, Alexander, Moose, Squirrel. the evil monocle.
I didn't dream it. It's actually a real thing. Robert De Niro with a monocle.
Randy Quaid was in it. Remember him?
Wow. You know when they show like the montage of De Niro's best roles, and they have, you know, the character he played in Raging Bull, and they have the guy he played in Cape Fear, and his role in Taxi Driver, and various others. They don't have this one on there, do they?
Oh, they have to. It's a classic.
The most evil De Niro villains. The most evil De Niro villains in history.
Well, like I say, Monocle. Evil Monocle. Monocle. Fearless leader. What a name for a character.
Yes.
Randy Quaid was Cappy Von Trapment.
Cappy what?
Cappy Von Trapment.
Cappy Von Trapment. Yeah, I mean, the movie was directed by Des McAniff. Jason Alexander playing the role of Boris. Piper Perabo playing Karen Sympathy.
Say the names alone.
Oh, Janine Garofalo playing Minnie Morgul.
Oh, Jonathan... Jenny Spy. Is Paige Brewster as Jenny Spy.
Carl Reiner playing PG Biggershot. Jonathan Winters playing Whopper Chopper Pilot and Ohio Cop with Bullhorn. And also Jeb.
All Jeb. Oh, Jeb.
Yeah. John Goodman playing Oklahoma Cop.
Hey, it's a classic. Oh, I'm just looking at the budget and how much it made in the box office. Yeah.
James Rebhorn playing President Sign-Off.
See, fantastic old movie. Well, it's old. It's 2000s, man, 2000s.
Oh, God.
Old. Yeah, but the thing military, is, that movie was great.
They've got military personnel. They've got General Admission, General Foods, General Store, Ed Gale playing The Mall.
It's kind of like the end of the Airplane movies.
Yeah.
Or Police Squad.
The FBI agents, one's called Potato, one's called Carrot, and one's called Radish. Oh, this is...
Screw New Rocky and Bullwinkle, going back to the film. I'm actually going to go on Netflix and see if they've got it. They actually have
the average family in this, with average dad, average mom, average grandma, average grandpa, average kid, and another average kid. And also average teen.
There's never any above average ones, is there?
No, it's the average family values.
I like what you did there. Back to the cut.
Yeah, but I mean, it's 18 years since the movie, and before the movie, it was probably, what, a good decade, at least a good 10, 15 years since we'd actually seen Rocky and Bullwinkle as regulars on TV. You're talking early to mid-80s.
It was quite a while.
Early to mid-80s was the last time I would say I remember seeing Rocky and Bullwinkle on terrestrial TV. And I've not seen Rocky and Bullwinkle as a property any time since 2000.
So it's like one of them celestial events where there's like a meteor that passes every now and then. And there's got to be a new Rocky and Bullwinkle to coincide.
I don't understand why Rocky and Bullwinkle. Maybe we're missing the point. Maybe it's because of the success of shows like Regular Show and Adventure Time, Phineas and Ferb. All those shows like that. So maybe
it's a reboot. It's got a very Gravity Falls-esque look to it. And I know that, like, this is the thing. These cartoons are start-up. They're, like, weird. They're quirky. Some of them, like Steven Universe and whatnot, they're, like, really good and they get you in the feels at times.
I'll be honest. Art style reminds me more of something like Regular Show or Phineas and Ferb than it does Gravity Falls.
No, I'm saying the artistic style. Obviously, the mismatched pair of a moose and a flying squirrel, just like what's Mordecai and Rigby, like a jaybird and a raccoon of sorts.
A jaybird and a weasel? I don't know. I can't remember.
Yeah, a baboon and a weasel. It's Cartoon Network's odd couple pairing thing. Like a dog that can transform into anything and a human kid.
Yeah, so why not just go for the actual Odd Couple, which I believe was it Jack Lemmon and who else?
Oh, no idea. I know that's referenced a lot, but one of the things in life, I have not seen The Odd Couple. I've seen where it's mentioned on Family Guy, the even couple, and he's got the tank, and he's like, there's no conflict in this. Boom. Tell you what, Family Guy's been picking up just on that point.
Odd Couple, Walter Matthau and Jack Lemmon.
One smokes cigars, the other one's clean.
Yeah. So, yeah, why not just go for that and just have two grumpy old men sitting in it, you know, sitting on lawn chairs, shouting at teenagers as they pass by?
Ah, doesn't the Muppets have a copyright on that?
I don't know, actually, because The Odd Couple's basically comedy, and it's like, you know, the whole nine yards that the Bruce Willis and, Matthew Perry, was it, who was from in Friends?
Chandler, yeah.
Yeah, the Bruce Willis, Matthew Perry thing. That was a very Odd Couple thing.
Hmm. Yeah, well, it's, I'm not sure how to feel about it until I say something like more substantial than just artwork.
Yeah.
Because it could work, it might not work. If it's anything like the movie, I enjoyed the movie just as daft, like family fun. I actually had it on DVD, and back then DVDs were worth something. So that's how dedicated I was.
So, yeah, that's a thing that's happening.
Slow news week.
It is a very slow news week. But then again, we'll probably have more next week. But anyway, on to better things, on to movie things, and we have a couple for you this week. Because we have been to the cinema, and we have been watching things. Shall we start off with the obvious first choice?
By the Dogs.
Yeah.
And the thing is, first thing, I believe this was discussed recently over on Cinema Eclectica.
Yeah, I have a slightly different take on it. I believe you probably will have a slightly different take on it as well.
Definitely, definitely do. If you want to head over to Cinema Eclectica's episode. This one is the animation side, I'd like to say, because they were more of the movie side. I like the cartoony side of it.
It's a Wes Anderson film, and before Isle of Dogs came out, Screen Junkies did one of their honest trailers of Wes Anderson. And I honestly didn't realise how many Wes Anderson films I'd actually watched until I watched that Screen Junkies honest trailer. And it was going through the different Wes Anderson films, like The Grand Budapest Hotel and The Royal Tenenbaums and films like that. And I've seen a lot more Wes Anderson films than I ever thought I had. Because I'll be honest, not really a big fan of Wes Anderson, or so I thought, until I realised that a lot of his movies that I'd watched, didn't know he was the director, but I like the movies. At that point, I was kind of conflicted about Isle of Dogs, because I'm like, I don't really like Wes Anderson, but I like a lot of his films. How should I feel about this?
Just like not many people like John Cena, but they like a few of his matches.
Yeah, basically. No,
so Wes Anderson is the John Cena of the film world.
Well, no, he's like an artistic John Cena. It's like if John Cena basically went into the middle of the ring with like a canvas and some paints and a brush and started painting his opponent first on the canvas. And then he took the canvas.
Don't give them ideas. He's already running out of things to do.
No, and then he took the canvas and he started smacking his opponent with the painting of his opponent. And just to be meta like that, you're like, look, it's a metaphor.
See, the truth is you're really hitting yourself.
Exactly. But before I get on to the actual film, let's talk about the production first.
Stop motion, absolutely amazing. I'm always blown away by stop motion films and how far they've came. Kubo and the Two Strings, especially last year.
Well,
it was fantastic, yeah. And they've kept up that kind of standard.
Well, Leica have been doing amazing stuff with stop motion, but it's not just Leica, because don't forget Anomalisa came out in the last couple of years as well. You know, the Charlie Kaufman one that I covered ages ago. And that was amazing for its stop-motion work as well. And now you've got Isle of Dogs, which, again, is another fantastic stop-motion movie. And it's just, it's amazing because when you watch any of the stuff about the production of Isle of Dogs, you find out little bits about how they made the movie. You know, when the dog's fur moves and stuff like that, apparently that was supposed to be an intentional thing, but then turned into an accidental thing or something like that.
Yeah, because they keep pausing at that and the fur keeps getting ruffled.
Yeah.
And they pass it off as wind.
Yep.
And there's one where like, everyone gets into a scuffle and it's just little bits of cotton wool.
Yeah.
as if it's like a cartoony fighting cloud.
Yeah. I love the idea of it being set in Japan. I don't think it needed to be set in Japan, but I love the idea of it being set in Japan. But that brings me on to the actual meat of the story itself, which, I'll be honest, was a little bit bland.
Mm-hmm.
It was a little bit bland. It was a little bit bare bones at times. The reason why is because the entire thing felt more like a love letter to Japan from Wes Anderson. It was more like a parade of things that Wes Anderson likes about Japan than an actual story set in Japan.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's... The thing is, the reviews and the critical response to this movie was... Somebody brought up cultural appropriation again.
I wouldn't say it was cultural appropriation. I would not say that. I would say that this is a love letter to Japan.
It is. It's a homage to the culture and the country itself. But it's that thing where it's white people getting offended on behalf of other cultures.
Yeah, but if we're not offended, then, you know, just have a Coke and a smile and shut up. Simple fact is, right, it's not cultural appropriation. It's basically a love letter. We both agree on that. And the reason why you can tell it's not cultural appropriation, it is an actual love letter. A little details, which I think people tend to overlook.
Atari Kobayashi.
Yeah. When Atari is looking for his dog, when he's shouting for his dog, what's the name he's shouting?
Spots.
Spotsu. Okay. Basically, Spots. Now, is Spots a Japanese name for a dog?
That depends. But it's mostly the Western name. It's like Fido or Rover.
Yeah.
Kind of
but
thing.
That's what I'm saying. It's basically a Western name for a dog. If it was in Japan and they want to call it Spots, they'd probably use the Japanese word for Spots. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah. And I mean, the other names as well, Rex, King, Duke, Boss, Chief. Yeah.
All the dogs have English Meg, names.
Very English.
Yeah. And so I think that's one of the reasons why it's getting mislabeled as cultural appropriation. There's a lot of westernization in there. It struck me while I was watching Isle of Dogs, because I've seen it a couple of times. I do like the movie a lot. But it struck me that Wes Anderson's view, or rather the view that Wes Anderson shows of Japan in Isle of Dogs, is the view that most people in the West who have never been to Japan and have never really read into Japanese culture and Japanese society, the kind of viewpoint that they have being just fans of Japanese pop culture. Does that make sense?
A weeb's eye view.
Yeah, a weeb's eye view, basically. What would you call a Western otaku if you didn't want to use the word weeb?
Tiaboo. Well, that's a British one, tiaboos.
Tiaboos. No. I want to include the word otaku in some way. So I was thinking, why don't you just call them wetakus?
Western otaku.
Yeah, or westaku.
Westaku sounds like a taco.
Yeah, exactly. They're crunchy on the outside, but soft in the middle.
And full of meat.
And some mysterious vegetables. No, let's not go there. You started this.
I'm sorry.
But anyway, that's the feeling I got from it. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, the thing with me was, because they use actual Japanese language in it.
Yeah.
And it's always interpreted. It's one of the funny little things at the beginning of the movie where it's like it's done through an interpreter, unpaid intern, and what have you.
Yeah.
But it's an interesting thing to actually keep the original Japanese language in it and have it interpreted all the way through, where some people would just say, oh, why don't you just do it in English?
Yeah.
You know?
And but that's the thing. Again, though, I actually think that's one of the reasons why it's not cultural appropriation.
That's not. It's his homage to Japan. Yeah. And it's not like it's in a real, like, prefecture of Japan. It's in this made-up one. There's a made-up scenario. You know, I don't know where, like, when the professor gets poisoned.
Yeah.
And they do through wasabi. It's like, is that a legitimate thing? Do people get poisoned with poison wasabi?
I thought that
was a bit weird.
If it's just a poison delivery method, then you can use all sorts of different things.
Yeah, I suppose. But it's just one of them things, like, oh, he's sitting there, he's eating sushi, and I mean, the oppression's pretty similar to the stuff that they do in China.
Yeah.
Where they put them under house arrest, keep people around them, stop them from getting any contact with the outside world. It's all a whole murky underground organization running things.
Yeah.
It's a bit like real life in a way.
Yeah, but then again, a lot of Westerners have rose-tinted viewpoints when it comes to Japan. And Japanese society, it's not as free and liberal as people like to think.
Oh, it definitely is. It's one of the most repressed.
Yeah.
Still.
The language is one reason why I disagree with the cultural appropriation label that's been given. Because if it was truly cultural appropriation, they basically would have done what, say, they did with the James Bond movie that was in Japan, you know, when they just whacked on some eyebrows on Sean Connery and said, oh yeah, he's Japanese now.
Aye.
Because that's cultural appropriation right there.
And borderline racism.
It wasn't borderline racism. Well, it was full-on racism. It was windmilling racism in everyone's faces. If they'd set it in Japan but had the language be English, I'd say that's cultural appropriation.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see what I mean?
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's one of the weird ones because the internet likes to argue and complain about things that really shouldn't be complained about when there's much more serious things going on in the world.
Yeah, just enjoy the film.
Yeah, just sit back and enjoy for what it was. I mean, I went with a Ben and they loved it, which was weird because like whenever I've got like subtitled anime on, the attention's not there. English dub, fine, but it's my daughter's just learning how to read the subtitles at the moment.
All right.
And she's becoming a lot better with the reading part. Gareth, he's just a bundle of whatever the hell's going on.
He doesn't care.
But he understands. He understands like the tone, the feeling, the emotion.
Yeah.
So he's got that down. So it's easy to understand. And like I say, Ben's, they're kind of picky when they come to movies. And it was good to like actually have silence for a bit. The plot itself, it was an interesting little prelude that they had.
Yes, I'll agree with that.
The whole like cats versus dogs thing. It's the evil empire run by cats and dogs are literally the underdog. But what made it for me was the personalities of each different dog. And the big names that voiced them as well.
Oh, God, yeah. That's some massive names. There was Bryan Cranston as Chief, Edward Norton as Rex, Bob Balaban, as King, Bill Murray as Boss, Jeff Goldblum as Duke. So you've got an all-star cast right there. And then Scarlett Johansson was Nutmeg.
Yeah, that was interesting because Donna like, turns to us and goes, is that Black Widow? It's like, yes, yeah. I believe it is.
Harvey Keitel as Gondo, F. Murray Abraham as Jupiter. Yoko Ono was in this as well as assistant scientist. Yeah,
herself.
Yeah, as assistant scientist Yoko Ono. Tilda Swinton was in this as Oracle. Ken Watanabe was the head surgeon.
That was actually funny, that the Oracle character in it.
Yeah.
I like that little bit of humor there where it's like she can predict everything, but it's like now she just understands what the people on the telly are saying.
The thing that I found hilarious about this, though, was the fact that Spots, the dog who they're all looking for, was actually Ray Donovan, or rather, his real person playing Ray Donovan, you know, Leif Schreiber. As we call him, the big friendly Leif Schreiber.
The biggest and friendliest around.
Yeah. You know, him being Spots was just, it was wonderful. And I really want to know how this works, right? Angelica Houston as the mute poodle.
I think she gets paid for every word.
That's what I mean.
Imagine that. We've got a great part in your big Hollywood movie. You get paid by the word. Paid by the word? Yes, paid by the word.
What's the role? Mute poodle. Can you imagine that on your acting resume? I played in major Hollywood motion pictures. What role did you play? I played the mute poodle.
We get voice actors, guests who are like that, like, oh, background of this movie or that movie.
Yeah.
And you just look like, yeah, fans are going to go wild for Man With Leg.
That's a very Rocky and Bullwinkle name right there, Man With Leg.
Plot, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a journey. That was basically it. One kid tries to find his dog. And the thing is, like, the whole socioeconomic background to it, it was slightly bizarre, but it made it fun. It made it more fun, like the whole using drones to track them down and sophisticated tracking systems for this one kid
Yeah.
It seems overkill because it's like his distant uncle.
Well,
it's like, oh, my distant nephew's gone missing.
It is a bit overkill. For me, the story was a bit bland, but I did like the sentimentality of it. I did like the fact that it didn't make any bones about it. It was just like a tongue-in-cheek comedy at times, you know, most of the time, in fact. But it was wearing its heart very firmly on its sleeve and saying, look, we're just here for this, that's all.
Yeah, that's the school protesters or the school dissenters club or whatever the hell they were.
Yeah.
That was another weird one because it's like the one Western kid with like the blonde afro who stood out. And she's the noisy one causing all the commotion. She's the one like, I'm doing a trick, it's supposed to be juggling balls and that. Can you just imagine it? And the other one's like, yeah, I can imagine that.
I'm trying. Tracy Walker, that was it, wasn't it? Greta Gerwig.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the fact that the one kid hacker.
Yeah.
It's just a cheesy hacker. Loved it. But it was a fun and enjoyable film. And like I say, it's the production quality and the stop motion that makes it like what really like to see.
This is where I kind of have to bring a bit of a downer to this. For me, it was kind of like Anomalisa. Only a lot more enjoyable than Anomalisa was. Anomalisa for me was basically a Communal Garden story with a bit of surrealism thrown in. What made it work was the fact that it was stop motion animation. If it had been live action, it wouldn't have been anywhere near as interesting. And it's to a lesser degree with Isle of Dogs because obviously you've got loads of dogs as characters. And if there's one thing that we all like seeing, it's dogs that talk like humans or animals that talk like humans.
Well, you see that there was a preview for a film that's coming on soon. It's like Undercover Dogs. Some dog gets to be an undercover cop, and they were given a Brazilian wax to a Rottweiler, which was
that's just not cool, man.
When you say everyone loves talking dogs, I'm thinking of that preview. I'm thinking not really.
See, I'm just thinking of something like The Incredible Journey, where you had Michael J. Fox playing the role of like a golden retriever or something like that. I can't remember.
Oh, Homeward Bound.
Homeward Bound, that was it. Yeah, that's the kind of movie that I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. Not not one where a Rottweiler gets waxed.
Not the one which has the obvious little chihuahua that talks like a Mexican, which is like not racist at all, apparently.
See, I would love it. I would love it if in one of these movies where they had talking animals, if the animals did not reflect their country of origin. So if the chihuahua was basically a proper British gentleman,
a German shepherd with an Irish accent.
No. The German shepherd obviously has to be Aussie. He's got to be Aussie, mate. And so just basically remove the whole idea of stereotypes and just play with it a little bit. So you've got like, you know, the bulldog, but the bulldog's basically sounds like a New York taxi driver. You know, really strong New York twang.
They did do that, didn't they, in Men in Black?
No, it was a pug, not a bulldog. It was a pug in Men in Black. But I mean, like a proper British bulldog, but have it stomping around, grumpy as anything. But when it opens its mouth, you can just imagine it behind the wheel of a New York taxi cab with a flat cap.
Oh, yeah. Well, see, talking dogs aside,
we're just making the greatest movie ever now.
Don't give people ideas without selling them. This is how we're poor, and everyone else is getting rich off our ideas.
Yeah. So anyway, Isle of Dogs, the clue is in the title. Let's be fair. Wes Anderson. I love dogs.
I love dogs. I love dogs. I love dogs. Say it over and over.
Yeah. He's basically saying he loves dogs and he loves Japanese pop culture. And so it's an homage to both, I'd say this film is.
Mm-hmm. It's more orange because, I mean, like you say, the critical reception it got was like, oh, it's cultural appropriation. Oh, it's just tourist cliches.
Yeah.
It's like just sit down and enjoy the movie for what it is rather than overanalyzing it to try and get clicks.
Yeah. It might be tourist cliches, but that's fine if they're done well. And in this, they are done well.
Yeah, no one's complaining, only you people.
Yeah. Anyway, we also have another big movie, but this time not from the West, but from the East.
Of all places.
Yeah, and this one is a massive, massive film for China, of all countries, Big Fish and Begonia.
Sounds like a special at a fancy restaurant. Would you like the Big Fish and Begonia, madam?
Oh, yes, I would absolutely love it.
Are you a chihuahua now?
I'm going rogue. And this is where we need Mark.
Big Fish and Begonia, it was released originally in China in 2016, and it's taken a couple of years for it to make the transition to the West. This film, I think the film was in development for a decade or 12 years or something like that, wasn't it?
It's been a while. It's a long journey for it.
It has been a very, very long journey, and it uses cel-shaded animation and CG cel-shaded animation, blends the two quite well. In terms of its production, I was really, really impressed.
It is. It is a stunning... the use of colour for me, the colours that were used in the movie, really stand out, very vivid. It's one of them things when they say, like, the psychology of colour, like reds make you feel angry, that they use that to like amplify the emotion that's in the, which gives an extra depth to the plot line.
Yeah. I mean, this is the thing. I thought the colour was just superb. One of the things that I thought, I thought the CG blending, at times it was a little slapdash, you could tell, but the majority of the time it was really well done. I mean, there's this one scene where, this isn't really a spoiler, because I'm not really going to tell you what these things are, I'm just going to tell you the actual movement. There's a scene where she basically gets up, goes to a box, and then you see her hand, and she just opens the drawer, slides the box open and takes out the bell. But that scene is so well done. It's CG, and you can tell it's CG. You can just tell it's CG, though. But it's so well done, and the animation is so fluid at that point. It's simply brilliant.
Yeah, we're going to have to agree with you on it. It's an interesting story, and like you say, it's from China. And what you're going to get is, with this movie, a lot of people saying, oh, well, it's like China's answer to Studio Ghibli. And can we stop saying that some like new animation from any other country apart from Japan is trying to be the new Ghibli when it's done in an anime style?
Well,
because that's going to get old really fast.
It is. It was all 10 years ago. It's done by Studio Mir, who are actually a South Korean animation studio. They're not Chinese. And, well, it's actually a collaboration. It's Studio Mir and B&T Studios. They basically produced this film, and Studio Mir, I know, have some really good history to them. They worked on various episodes of The Legend of Korra. They worked on season 4 of The Boondocks. They've done some Doraemon stuff, some Guardians of the Galaxy shorts. They've worked on Voltron Legendary Defender, Lego Elves, The Secrets of Elvendale, various things like that. So they do actually have a good pedigree.
It's just that people are just like, oh, well, it's a new Ghibli, isn't it? It's the one thing I keep seeing with like things. It's like the answer to Studio Ghibli, and it's like, please stop using Ghibli as the yardstick.
I honestly don't like it being compared to Ghibli, because it's not Ghibli. In terms of the story, in terms of the tone, in terms of the film itself, it's not a Ghibli film. I mean, in terms of the folklore and the mythos that it's based on and where it comes from, there's a bit at the end of the film where it talks about the tree Takun and how it had a spring that lasted 8,000 years and an autumn that lasted the same. And the spring was called Chun and the autumn was called Chu. Mm-hmm. And that's the name of two particular characters in the film, as in two of the main characters in the film, Chun being the girl and Chu being the white-haired boy.
Who are all Chu.
Yeah, but the thing is... that, I thought, was a very appropriate thing to just kind of put on at the end. What I thought about the film itself, I mean, I understood a fair bit of where this film has come from, because I've looked into the development of it a lot. I've been waiting for this film for a while, because I've been reading a lot of stuff related to Chinese folklore and mythology. And so when they're talking about, at the beginning, how they live in the world beneath the oceans, and how they control the wind and the sky and the waves, but they're not gods, they're just the others.
Yeah, it's not really a realm of gods or demigods. It's more, yeah. It's just nature.
Yeah,
in a way.
Basically, that's what they are. They're beings that belong as part of nature, and they basically kind of caretakers of nature, caretakers of the balance of the world. And that's what this film, I think, primarily is about, is balance.
It is. It's because as the plot goes, these people from Underworld, they're sent to the human world to just experience humanity for 7 days, I believe it is.
Well, it's not so much humanity. They're there to experience the world. It's not humanity. In their eyes, humanity isn't really that important compared to the actual world itself and the laws of nature itself. So what they're experiencing is the changing of the seasons, the tides, the waxing and waning of the sun and moon, those sorts of things. Those sorts of things are far bigger than any one person or any race.
Yeah, but humanity's there, and there's always the warning of, be careful, humans are up there.
Yeah, and there's a reason why.
Obviously.
Which we won't get into, but they do get into that in the film. The film itself, I don't know, what did you think of the story?
I thought it was pretty good. Some parts of the folklore were a bit hard to grasp at first for me, personally. But that's because I'm not really into Chinese folklore. I know of a few bits and pieces, but most of my knowledge is based in the mainstream, like the story of monkey and whatnot.
Yeah,
that's basically. I've got a very very sparse. Give us on Japanese mythology. I know a damn sight more. British mythology, easy. Chinese mythology, patchy in places.
Yeah.
So that was a learning experience for me at the start. The fact they say it's big fish and begonia being the trees and Chun's power. What would you call it? A power or Chun's nature.
The thing is, they all have powers and abilities. All the others. Have powers and abilities that differ from one person to the next. And part of the rite of passage is basically solidifying, gaining control of that power, actually understanding how it applies in the world. One of the things that I found interesting was the little kind of dig at the Japanese. Did you notice it?
No, but tell us and I probably might have.
Okay, the little dig at the Japanese has to do with dolphins.
It's that
bit right at the beginning after Chun. This is not a spoiler, by the way, because this happens right at the beginning of the movie. Chun goes to the human world and she is in the form of a red dolphin. And there is a boat that is basically, it's harvesting dolphins. And it's a little bit of a dig at the Japanese.
Like we say, Japan's not all like the smiles and pretty girls in maid outfits and whatnot. There's still barbaric hunting of dolphins and whales.
Yeah. And so that was a little bit of a dig at the Japanese, which I found actually quite cute. I'll be honest. I thought it was very subtly done and a lot of people probably haven't noticed it.
I'll be honest. I didn't think of it as that. I just saw it as just caught in a net.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying.
Like you said, it is harvesting.
Yeah.
And it's specifically harvesting dolphins because that's where they appear and disappear.
Yeah. And that's why I say it's a very subtle jab at the Japanese, especially the Japanese fishing industry, because she's in the form of a dolphin and she ends up getting caught in the net. But for her and the others who live under the ocean, they're the ones responsible for the balance of nature. So the idea is by killing a dolphin, you're committing a sin against nature. Do you see?
Yeah.
And so
it's a lot more complex than just a couple of dolphins visiting human world. Yeah.
And so that's why I said it's a very subtle dig at the Japanese, at the Japanese fishing industry, which I found, like I said, I found it quite cute, very well done. Hats off to them for the very subtle little barb there. But, yeah, I have to agree. The film was kind of, it was a little bit, I'll be honest, I found it a little bit sanctimonious at times.
Yeah, it's about the balance of nature, bloody hippies.
I found it a little bit preachy every so often.
It's more than every so often. Mm. It was like the main kind of like running theme. The whole, like, you know, bit take care of things and that, and you can't break the law of nature, and if you do, you know, there will be consequences.
Yeah.
And it was interesting to see, like, the whole afterlife part of it.
Yeah.
The one who looks after the human souls, that was an interesting thing, and you just walk through and all the human souls that have gone would become tadpoles in a bowl in this guy's collection. That was weird.
Yeah. I was trying to think of a film that I would liken Big Fish and Begonia to. The obvious choice is Spirited Away. And I know loads of people are immediately going to say, you know, if you loved Spirited Away, then you must watch this film. And then I thought, hang on, I have actually seen a film that has a very similar idea, and that was Yobi the Five-Tailed Fox. It's a Korean animated film from 2007, which was directed by Lee Sung-gang. And I really like that film, even though it involves kind of a little five-tailed fox called Yobi and aliens who've been trapped on Earth for 100 years and a boy that Yobi quite likes who dies in the middle.
Oh.
Yeah. It has a lot of parallels with Big Fish and Begonia, even though it came out almost a decade before Big Fish and Begonia, while Big Fish and Begonia was in the initial planning stages, in fact. And so I'm wondering if Liang Xuan and Zhang Chun, who are the writers, producers, and directors of Big Fish and Begonia, if they've actually seen Yobi the Five-Tailed Fox and took some influence from it.
It would be a possibility.
Yeah. Because Yobi focuses on the folklore type thing as well, in the way that Big Fish and Begonia does.
Yeah.
And it uses it quite well as well. Yes, there are aliens in Yobi, but don't worry about that too much.
Yeah, the History Channel is already full of aliens anyway, and that, you know, most people use that as actual factual research material.
Never mind the History Channel. Have you seen them on BBC?
is that the one where the ask three women to get their consumer problems sorted?
No, these women are really
aliens.
I'm saying that I'm almost certain that Simon Sharma is from Uranus.
He smells a bit funny, doesn't he?
So anyway,
they should have kept it named George. It would have ruined so many jokes in the future.
Yeah, I know.
If only they knew.
And essentially, this story is about balance, but it's also, I mean, the guilt part for Chun. I thought it was a bit overdone.
Mm-hmm.
I understand the whole idea of repaying your debt and everything like that. And that actually harks back to kind of old Chinese society, old Chinese culture, the ancient way of looking at the world. If somebody saved your life, then they basically...
You owed a life debt.
You owed a life debt, basically. You know, and people took it really seriously because in those times, it was a much more brutal world. Yes, civilization was there, but it hadn't taken root in kind of the outskirts of cities and places like that. So there was still a lot of barbarism around. There was still a lot of dangers in the world.
Mm.
And so life had a lot more meaning at that point. So I can understand from that perspective, but it didn't quite fit, if that makes sense.
No.
Yeah, there was this weird idiosyncrasy, and it was right at the beginning of the film when Chun first goes to the human world. And unfortunately, it's also linked to the subtle barb that they aimed at the Japanese. It's to do with the boy that Chun meets, right? When you see his version of fishing, which is basically just stretch a net across and see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the boat with the nets that are being hauled up and they've got the harpoons and everything like that.
Yeah.
That's the kind of idiosyncrasy that I'm talking about. There's a weird thing where it doesn't quite match, because them doing the whole hauling of the net and stuff like that, for them to be hauling all those dolphins, they had to have been using motorized winches or something like that, because they couldn't ever do it by hand.
Huge mammals, and
yeah,
they're going to struggle.
Yeah, they could never haul that many dolphins by hand with just a few men on a boat. It'd have to be motorized winches or something. And that's what I mean, because then you have on the other side this boy living without electricity or anything like that with his little sister, and their only entertainment is this little dolphin-shaped ocarina. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah. So it's kind of like, well, what do they do for fun?
Yeah. And it's obvious that they don't live that far away from Japan.
Which back in them times probably a battleground.
Yeah, which I'm assuming, you know, I'm assuming it's Japan. On the balance of the evidence, it's a fair assumption to make, I'd say. But that's my take on it.
That's, for me, it was the whole relationship between Chun and, how do you pronounce the kid's name, the one with the white hair? Is it Ki?
Chu. Chu.
Chi.
Chu.
Chu.
Yeah, because you've got to remember, Q and I is Chi.
All right. So Chu, anyway, so there's this whole thing, like, in their world, this is before she goes into the human world, like, obviously, the best friends.
Yeah.
And I'm watching this with Donna, and I turn to her, like, because Chu turns out to be, like, this little rascalish kind of character. I'm like, oh, he's going to be an absolute dick later in the movie. And later in the movie, I'm turned around 180 degrees, and then another 270, then another 360, and about another 180, because I'm all over with it. I've discussed this with you before, Rob. Like, I think, like, she friend-zoned Chi for Free Willy.
Yeah, we disagree on this, by the way.
Yeah.
To all of us, we actually do disagree on this. Tucky reckons he got friend-zoned. I reckon he didn't.
So Rob, how would you explain the plot?
Well, I'd say a girl goes into the human world as a dolphin. Girl sees boy. Their eyes meet across a crowded ocean. Things happen. It goes a bit pear-shaped. She has to go back, but she feels guilty because of things that she did. In the human world, she hasn't learned that what happens on tour stays on tour. and so she wants to make amends, but, you know, she hasn't learned the first lesson of what happens on tour stays on tour. When you try and make amends, things go very, very pear-shaped very, very quickly. And so she has to learn hard lessons.
And part of this lesson, because it's a personal lesson for herself, but on that way, Chu's obviously, like, he's already invested in her,
yeah,
so to speak. And so the progression of their relationship during the whole movie, it turns out it's kind of like a unrequited love, if yeah. you will. It might not have went that way had she not went through the rite of passage.
Yeah.
But it did, because it makes a better plot. And at the end, there's a part where, like, he's traded something valuable to basically help her out.
Yeah.
And she's basically, he's like, no, I only like you as a friend. Not like exactly like, oh, no, yeah, we're going to be friends, mate. Don't worry.
See,
it's,
yeah. See, that's where you and I disagree on this. Because you're basically saying she's made a choice, and I'm saying that it wasn't really a choice, you know. It's not about friend zones or anything like that. Because from my perspective, at that point, he's made, you know, Chu's made a choice to do whatever it is he needs to do. But Chun, by that point, has basically become more like a mother character or a mother figure, if that makes sense. Which is one of the
reasons.
Well,
no, I can understand. I mean, I'm not saying, like, you know, oh, well, you know, he's done so much for her. Obviously, she owes him because, you know, that's a very misogynistic way to look at it. And say, well, I think you owe me, don't you? I'm not saying that. It's just, it kind of feels like, I don't know, it kind of feels like she really underappreciated him for all of his sacrifice during the movie.
The perspective I'm looking at it from is, by that point, for me, Chun was basically like a single mom, a working single mom. And you know a few working single mums as well, and they're tough as nails, aren't they?
Stubborn as them as well, but
yeah, and
that's just the way it is.
They're stubborn because that's a defense mechanism. That's basically them getting their head down and plowing forward because they have to. There's someone depending on them. And for me, Chun, later on in the film, is a bit more like that. Okay, yeah, she's basically still stressed about what happened on tour. And that's going to be my phrase, by the way. It's vague enough so you don't know exactly what I'm talking about. But
it happens on tour.
Yeah. She's still stressed about what happened on tour, you know, between her and the guy. And I'm making it sound like a totally different film here. I know I am.
Those roadies.
Yeah, and she's still stressed about that. And so she's trying to make amends. I mean, I'm making it worse by describing her as a single mum now as well.
We'll agree to disagree. This is where we need like a third or fourth person.
Yeah, we do.
To interject.
Mark or Andrew, you know, we needed you here for this.
You let us down, man.
So we have to rely on you, the listeners, right? I have a different perspective. I think that right at the end, Chun realized exactly how much Chu meant to her. But by that point, it was far too late.
Yeah.
I think that's basically what happened. By the time she realized it was too late for anything to change, what was then going to happen had to happen. There was no changing that outcome by that point. And so she basically had to live with the consequences of her actions once again, which would explain why she's the narrator right at the beginning.
Yeah. Not really a spoiler, though, that, is it?
No, it's not really a spoiler. One thing that I do want to bring up before we finish, though, is the quality of the English dub. I was very impressed.
Yeah, I'm in agreement with that as well. It's it was really well done. I haven't seen the voice cast. Didn't sound like too many familiar voices, if any at all, were used. Interesting that, because is it Chinese yen the currency in China? Or Chinese dollar? Or
it's yuan, isn't it?
Oh, yuan. There we go. Yeah. So it costs like 30 million yuan to make, and it's already box office about 565 million yuan.
Yeah.
It's a really big success, movie-wise.
Yeah, it is a really big success. I mean, there are a couple of familiar names in the voice cast, by the way. JB Blong plays Ling Po. Johnny Yong Bosch plays Chu.
Ah.
Yeah. Greg Chun plays Ho Tu, Chun's father, and Chi Song-ji. Todd Habakkuk plays Kun, and if you watch the film, you'll find out who Kun is. Erika Ishii plays Lei Zu. Cassandra Lee Morris plays Kun's sister. Stephanie Shea plays Chun.
Oh, Stephanie Shea. I haven't heard that name in a while.
Yeah. Yuri Lowenthal plays Guo Mang and Ting Mu.
So it's basically Funimation, isn't it?
Yeah, it's basically Funimation's roster of voice actors.
It's still impressive nonetheless, because I couldn't recognise a single one of them. And I've met these people in real life.
Well, this sort of thing,
they've done a really good job.
Yeah, they've done a brilliant job, I'd say. And I think one of the reasons is because this had a much bigger budget, and because of the actual status of this film, as in it's the Chinese film that they're hoping will break the mould, will basically break through and break Japan's death grip on animated movies coming from the East. Does that make sense?
I'll tell you what, it's put a great case forward for itself, yeah. If anything.
It has, it has. And so
we're always critical of people who like only stick to anime and like the purists, sort of, and it's like you can't close off your mind, you can't close off...
I wouldn't call them purists, I'd call them idiots.
The purist mentality, the Brexit mentality.
That's not purist mentality. That's Puritan mentality, not purist. Now, if you want to be Puritan about anime, then go away.
It's the wrong kind of medium for you.
Yeah, yes, exactly. Just go live, you know, like Amish people or something like that. They're Puritan.
So we're saying it is. I mean, it's taken a long time, but it is getting released in the UK through Manga Entertainment.
Yeah.
Listed cinemas. I'll be sharing them up on the Sony computer. I think we'll be able to put them up on our Twitter at Keyframe Podcast. So
yeah,
snuck it in there, and we'll put up any screenings of it around. But it's one of them ones I'd like to see actually on the big screen, because I mean the screener we got, we get like the test ones where you watch it on your laptop and you don't get the full effect. And I reckon, like, sound, full proper sound on a surround sound system,
I reckon,
in a cinema on the big screen.
If you watch this in the cinema on the big screen with proper sound, it'll sound amazing. And also, a recommendation from me, the English dub is very, very good. So, yes, you can definitely watch that. But if you want the full effect, because there are certain things that are kind of lost a bit in translation, or lost a bit in terms of making it easier for the voice actors to convey the emotion and, you know, the tone of what they're saying. And so it can get a bit mistranslated, particular phrases, sentences, that sort of thing. In general, the English dub was very, very good, but you can't get away from that. That's going to happen when you translate anything. You know, it's but they have taken a lot of care with this, right? A hell of a lot of care. And it shows if you basically do a comparison between the Chinese dub with the subtitles and the actual English dub as well, or the American dub, I should say. I would say that you can watch this in either dub and enjoy it equally. If you are a regular of anime, though, I would advise watching the English dub rather than the Chinese dub, because your first reaction, if you watch this in Chinese, if you've never watched anything Chinese before that's been subtitled, you might find it a bit weird. You might find it a bit off-kilter. Would that be fair to say,
Definitely. I mean, you get used to Japanese subtitles and whatnot. And
well, you get used
different
to...
different languages. I mean, try watching something with Portuguese or with subtitles. That weirded me out.
Yeah, I have done, but this is the thing. For a lot of anime fans, they won't have branched out to things outside of anime yet, especially the younger ones. They'll be stuck inside anime. So if they want to watch this, they've only got two options, the English dub or the Chinese dub. And if they've never watched anything animated that's Chinese or has Chinese language in it, then they might struggle a little bit at first. I mean, eventually, you know, we're humans, we adapt. They'll get over it, but it might knock their enjoyment of the film, and that's something that I think would be a shame.
Yeah, well, it's a difficult language to start with.
Yeah,
personal opinion, but most of the world now speak Mandarin, so you know we here in the United Kingdom we're used to like just English, you know, a simple language. If you don't speak English, you don't belong. Kind of mentality, but the world needs to change, and there's a lot more languages out there. And
I thought you knew. I thought you knew English is a dialect of Mandarin.
Is it? No. I thought it was French.
No. I was trying to make out that we're all speaking Mandarin, really. It failed. You killed my joke. Oh,
you killed it yourself. But it's definitely worth going to watch. If not, you know, there'll be a DVD release, there'll be a Blu-ray release, which will show you some of the behind-the-scenes stuff, I dare say, because they're starting to put them extras back on, which is a good thing. Yeah. So it's worth the money. Unlike some of the things where it's just like, oh, here, I have the TV show, and we'll charge like 30 quid for two episodes of it.
Yeah. But yeah,
I still can't believe in this day and age people are doing that still.
Yeah.
I still can't believe it.
That's it from us for this week. We'll be back next week, hopefully with everybody returned and healthy. If you want to listen to any of our previous shows, you'll find them on our website or on Audio Boom. And you can also find us on Apple Podcasts as well. If you are going to go to our website, thegeekshow.co.uk, then check out our shop. We have new lines of merchandise. And we also have a Patreon, so you can also support us that way. It won't cost you much as well.
Believe it, we've only got one tier. Anything.
No, we don't have tiers, which means we've got one tier. A single tier. It's a single tier. Crossing down the cheek. We're not going to tell you which cheek. Anyway. Leaving that to one side, dodgy jokes aside.
So you've got a listener there like, oh. There's like, oh. I was going to donate, but this is an uncouth podcast.
Yeah, I mean, it just went, oh. That's us for this week. We'll be back next week. Until then, I have been Rob.
And I've been Tucky.
And we'll see you all later.
Goodbye.